We'll continue with what we were doing this morning. We had just, when I stopped, when we ran out of time, we were talking about the Third Council during the period of Ashoka. And, of course, the principal effects of the Third Council were, first of all, to drive the Sarvastivadins to the northwestern part of India, to Kashmir. That was one effect of the council. Not, I might say, an intentional effect, but an accidental effect or a natural effect. The other important result of the council was, of course, the sending of missionaries, because the missionaries that we know of with any sort of completeness were of course, the missionaries that Ashoka sent to Sri Lanka, his own son or nephew, Mahinder, and his sister, Sangamitra, who established Buddhism in Sri Lanka. So this is one mission of which we have concrete historical and evidence. We have evidence of the success of the outcome of this mission, because we have the establishment of Sri Lankan Buddhism from this period of Ashoka's missionaries. But we are told that he sent missionaries to various directions, and we don't know for certain what success these missionaries met with. We have some scattered reports of Ashoka's missions being seen as far west as Egypt. They certainly went to northeastern India, to the countries that bordered what is now Burma and Thailand. They also went to Central Asia. But we don't have any definite proof that those missions met with any notable success. But what we do know is that by the beginning of the Christian era, after another 200 or 300 years, Buddhism had begun to influence extensively, particularly Central Asia, the northwestern part of the subcontinent, what is now Afghanistan, Iran also, and the countries of Central Asia like Uzbekistan and Tajikistan and so forth. So we have the missions, and we have also the diaspora, we can call it that, the migration of the Sarvastivadins to Kashmir, which in its own right had a big effect on the development of Buddhism in India. We also had the composition of the first, what we might call, polemical work in Buddhism. We had the composition of a book called the Katavattu, which came to be part of the Abhidharma Pitaka, which is a discussion and a refutation of the views of the various schools that were represented at the council. So we have there some quite intricate and complicated discussion of the philosophical views of various of those 18 schools that developed between the time of the Second Council and the time of the Third Council. Next, I'm going to talk just a little bit about the Fourth Council. And the Fourth Council is quite a bit later. The Fourth Council takes place probably at the end of the first century CE. Now, I don't think that I have to tell you, most of you are familiar with Buddhism and with Buddhist usage. We refer to what a lot of people refer to as AD, rather than using the denomination AD, we use the denomination CE in Buddhism. which is an abbreviation of the word common era. We don't use the words AD, which you can find in a lot of other texts and a lot of other traditions. Does anybody know why we don't use the words AD? Yeah, it's Christian, but what does it mean? Do you know what it means? Do you know what it stands for? No, it actually stands for the Latin Anno Domini, which means the year of our Lord. So we don't want to say the year of our Lord, since he wasn't our Lord. And so we don't use AD, we use CE, which is a neutral definition. That's why we use BCE also, incidentally, which is before Common Era, not the BC of the Christian or Western world, which is before Christ. We use BCE and we use AD. And I really must commend the Thais, those of you, the Thai people who are here and the Thai people who are hosts in this beautiful country. I must commend you for using the Buddhist year, continuing to use the Buddhist year. I remember we were in Ayutthaya for the quote-unquote millennium, 2000 AD or CE or whatever. And the next day we went and we bought a train ticket for Bangkok. The train ticket said 2542 or something like that. And for a moment we thought, what is wrong? Something is wrong with the computer. What is wrong? And then we realized, of course, that it's the Buddhist year. So that's perfectly correct. Of course, I mean, Muslims also use a Muslim year, and the Zoroastrians also use the Muslim. They use their own year as well. But in any case, we refer to the period after the first century at CE. Now, this council took place probably about 100 CE. We date it at that point in time because it was held under the auspices of a king by the name of Kanishka, who was a Central Asian king. I think he was a Kushana king. One of the Central Asian peoples that ruled over Western India, Afghanistan, Kandahar. Today we're used to hearing all of these names in the news, Kandahar, Herat, etc. They were Buddhist countries. They were cities in the Buddhist world in the first century CE. Pity they didn't stay that way. Kanishka ruled over this region of northwestern India, and his dates are about 100 CE. And we also have an interesting coincidence. It would appear that the great Buddhist poet, Ashwaghosha, I'm talking now Sanskrit literature and Mahayana Buddhism, but Ashwaghosha, who was the author of the Buddha Charita, the life of the Buddha, the text that was roughly translated, which the text upon which Edward Arnold's The Light of Asia, the famous poem, was based. That poem, of course, had a great influence upon the spread of Buddhism and interest in Buddhism in the West. Anyway, Ashwaghosha, who was the author of that text, and the author of several others, including one in praise of the Buddha, a beautiful poem in praise of the Buddha, It would seem that Ashwa Gosha was invited to attend the council by Kanishka, but he declined because of his advanced age. He said that he was too old to travel so far to attend the council. But instead he wrote a letter to the king. He wrote a letter to King Kanishka, a text called the Kanishka Lekha. And it is one of a whole class of Buddhist texts. Later you find Nagarjuna writing a letter to a king, the Sura Lekha. And later still you find Buddhist scholars like Atisha and others writing letters to various kings. And these are letters which are not simply letters, but they're letters. There's also a text written by Chogyal Pakpa, a famous learned Tibetan monk who wrote a letter to Kublai Khan. So this was the beginning, perhaps, of a tradition of letter writing to kings, where Buddhist monks wrote letters to kings. And these were not ordinary letters that simply said, excuse me, I'm very old, I can't come to the council. These were letters that contained teachings. And Kanishka Lekha, which I had the good fortune to work on many, many years ago, to work on the translation, it is very beautiful. It contains a lot of very important Dharma teaching. And especially Ashwa Gosha concentrates on trying to persuade the king to give up hunting. And so he talks about how the king and the deer and so forth that he hunts are basically the same, how both love life and both fear death. And he talks about how the eyes of the deer look when the king is about to shoot them, and how the king should generate pity on them and spare their lives and so forth. So it's a very interesting letter. Anyway, with the help of this letter and the date of Ashwa Gosha and the date of King Kanishka, we can put the council sometime around the end of the first century CE. This council was different from the other councils in a couple of ways. First of all, its location. We're not 100% sure where it was located, where it took place, but it certainly took place in the northwestern part of India. May have been Jalandhar in what is now Pakistan, in what is now the Punjab. Excuse me, Prime Minister Manmohan Singh. Not Pakistan, but the Punjab. Or it could have been even further north and further west. It could have been in Kandahar. It could have been somewhere in what is now Pakistan. In any case, this council was held. And as you would expect, since the northwestern part of India had become a stronghold of the Sarvastivada, the principal participants at the council were Sarvastivadins. By that time we had a couple of schools of Sarvastivadins. We had the Mula Sarvastivadins or the Root Sarvastivadins, and we had the Kashmiri Sarvastivadins or the Kashmiri Vibhashikas. And there were some minor differences between these schools. This proliferation of schools, of course, it began with the first 18 schools. But then it went on. The Buddhist schools continued to divide and subdivide. And this is something which has been a characteristic of Buddhism. In fact, it is still a characteristic of Buddhism. It is still true of Buddhism that Buddhist schools, Buddhist centers, Buddhist organizations tend to divide. When I first went to California, some people encouraged me to direct, to teach at a Dharma study group, to form a Dharma study center. And so we formed a Dharma study center in Chico. It was called the Chico Dharma Study Group. This was the group that originally published the Tree of Enlightenment. We were a non-sectarian group. We invited teachers from all traditions, Vipassana, Zen, Vajrayana, and I was the sort of regular teacher at that group. Well, my point is that within 3 to 4 years, there were 5 Buddhist groups in Chico. When we started the Chico Dharma Study Group, we were the first. We were the only Buddhist group in Chico. Within 3 or 4 years, there were 5 groups. Now the Chico Dharma Study Group no longer exists, except in cyberspace. It is still on the internet. It doesn't exist physically. I keep getting emails from people who want to come for the meetings. I have to tell them, well, it doesn't, it only exists on the internet. It doesn't exist anymore in real time and space. But anyway, my point is that Buddhist groups have always had a tendency to divide and subdivide. And some people regard this as a weakness. I personally don't think it's a weakness. I think it's actually a strength, because it continues to make room for different points of view, for different interests. So, for example, what happened in California, in Chico, was that we had a Zen group evolve from the Chico Dharma Study Group, we had a Vipassana group evolve, we had groups pursuing their particular Buddhist interests, which is fair enough. I have nothing to say against that. So in any case, in the Fourth Council, we had the domination, we can say, of the Sarvastivadins. Now, I should tell you a little bit about the evolution of the Sarvastivada, because the Sarvastivada was a very influential school. And this is why earlier I said that the evolution, the development of the Mahayana was not a straightforward, straight and narrow, one-directional evolution. Because different schools contributed in their own ways to the evolution of the Mahayana. Now, if you look at the Sarvastivada school from their, let us say, their philosophical point of view, if you look at them from a philosophical point of view, they were a very pluralistic and realistic school. The Sarvastivadins multiplied and enforced the idea of self-existing dharmas, self-existing factors. From that point of view, they were the Abhidharmika school par excellence. They were the Abhidharmika school, the most extreme Abhidharmika school. And because of this tendency to regard factors as real, as having swabhava, as having self-existence, this is a term that we're going to be talking about quite a lot when we talk about the development of the emptiness doctrine in the Mahayana. But because of their belief in these in factors and dharmas having swabhava, they got into trouble. They actually, this was the issue over which they got into trouble at the Third Council, because they believed in the existence of all dharmas. That is where they get their name, Sarva Asti. All dharmas existed. Now, among the dharmas that existed were the past and the future. So for the Sarvasti Vadins, the past existed, and the future also existed, just like the present. For the Vibhajya Vadins, only the present existed. Now this is another issue that I'm sure at some point in this course, if you pursue the whole BA course, at some point or other, someone will discuss this with you at length, perhaps at too much length. But the fact is, both positions are rather absurd, in the sense that, in what sense, how does the past exist? It doesn't have the same sort of existence as the present. But then again, how does the present exist without the past? If you don't have past and future, what is present? There's no present without past and future also, because we only imagine present in relation to past and future. The Sarvasti Vadins also invented something to account for the preservation of karma, right? In other words, what exactly is it that causes us to be reborn in a certain condition, in certain circumstances? We as Buddhists, we all believe that we are born in a particular situation because of our karma, right? But how does that happen? Since we're just a bunch of processes, we're just a collection of aggregates, of heaps, and these heaps perish at the point of death, so how is it that I come by my past karma? Where do I get my past karma? Now there are different answers to this. I don't expect you to, I'm sure you know some of the answers, and I know some of the answers. We won't go through all of the answers now. But the Sarvasti Vadins, they came up with a very convenient solution. They said to everybody that there's a factor, again, a real factor that exists. It has its own nature. A factor called prapti, which means acquisition or ownership, which is kind of like a promissory note or something like that. So you get a sort of report card when you die, and that's what, according to the report card, you're born as a dog or as a king or whatever you're going to be reborn as. So they took this, what we call in philosophical terms, what we call realism, they took this to quite an extreme length. Everything was real, everything had its own independent existence, although of course it was interrelated. But all the factors that were variously interrelated were also real. They also had their own nature, their own swabhava. So this was their philosophical aspect. Now this is just about as far as you can go, just about as far away as you can get from the Mahayana view of dharmas, which is dharma nairatmya, or the non-self, or the insubstantiality, the emptiness of factors. The Sarvastivada view is just about diametrically opposed to the Mahayana view with regard to the description of reality, the description of what actually exists. Are you following me, or is this getting too abstruse?
It's okay.
So they were very far away on that count, but in other ways they were very Mahayanic. In other ways, they had very strong Mahayana tendencies. How? First of all, they had very close and continuous relations, connections with the laity. The Sarvastivadin centers, the temples, the monasteries, most of them were in cities. They were in urban areas. They had walkways where the population, the ordinary people, could come and circumambulate the temples. The monks were living in the inner quarters, they were carrying on their monastic duties, but the lay people used to come into the monastery, circulate the temples, circulate the shrine. The monasteries were located in the urban centers, and the monks had continuous contact with the lay people. This again is a characteristic of of the Mahayana, having a very close connection with the lay people. I know this now this is something which exists even in Theravada countries, but in those days it was characteristic of the Sarvastivadins. They were the first to put their temples and monasteries, for example, Takshashila, great Buddhist center in northwestern India, northwestern part of the subcontinent. We won't necessarily, sometimes I refer to India, just take it that I'm referring to the subcontinent, I'm not referring to the political lines that have been drawn on the map in the last 50 years. It was a great Buddhist center, and the Sarvastivada Monastery was right smack dab in the middle of the city. So that was one area. But more importantly, they developed, they were also extremely interested in the previous lives of the Buddha. They focused on the Jataka stories and on murals and various portrayals of the Jataka stories. They, if you like, they fostered, they promoted the cult of the Jatakas, the fascination with the interest in the previous lives of the Buddha Shakyamuni. They began to talk about three vehicles and the legitimacy of three vehicles, the acceptability of three vehicles, the three vehicles being the, I think you, someone here will must know what we mean by the three vehicles. No. So these are things which are characteristics of the Mahayana. You'll see in the Lotus Sutra how it deals with the question of the three vehicles. And finally, they began to promote the idea that they're great teachers. For example, one of the heads of the Sarvastivada was a person, a monk by the name of Sanghamitra. They began to promote the idea that this Sanghamitra was a bodhisattva and that he would become a future Buddha. So that by the first century CE, the Sarvastivadins had a conception whereby they had a whole row, a whole queue of their great teachers lined up behind Maitreya, waiting to become the future Buddha. A future Buddha. Of course, first there would be Maitreya, then after that there would be Sanghamitra, then after that there would be Vasumitra, and so on and so forth. So here also you have a very Mahayanic sort of conception. So while on the one hand, philosophically, they were very conservative, and very typical of a Hinayana school with realistic, pluralistic view of reality, on the other hand, on the practical side, on the ethical side, they promoted close relationships with the laity. They fostered and developed the cult of the previous lives of the Buddha, of the Jatakas, and they developed this conception of a long line of future Buddhas, a long line of bodhisattvas, a long line of masters who were bodhisattvas and who would, in the fullness of time, become Buddhas. So they had a lot to contribute to the Mahayana. The Mahasanghikas, they concentrated on their conception of the Buddha and on emphasizing the supramundane or supernatural qualities of the Buddha. So they didn't talk a lot about the bodhisattva path or future Buddhas and so forth. The Sarvastivadins, on the other hand, they didn't talk too much about the Buddha's qualities, but they did cultivate, they did develop this conception of the bodhisattva career, of the calling to become a Buddha. So influences, formative influences, which made up the Mahayana, the full-fledged Mahayana, came from various sources. They didn't come only from the Mahasanghikas. Even the Vatsiputriyas, the personalists, had something to contribute, and I'll talk about that a little bit later this afternoon. But these various schools, they all had something to contribute to the Mahayana conception. The Mahayana conception was a product of multiple influences emanating, coming out of the various schools that developed after the Second Council. It's also not, maybe not accidental, it's also not coincidental that the Sarvastivadins used Sanskrit as their medium of instruction, as their as a medium of their texts. And of course we know that the Mahayana language of choice was Sanskrit. So there are some indications that the Mahayana, the formation of the Mahayana, the development of the Mahayana also depends upon Sarvastivadin contributions, is also indebted to the contribution of the Sarvastivadins. Now, the interesting issue that arose at the Fourth Council was that by this time we had another Buddhist school. There were two schools which were the most important schools, the schools that debated the orthodoxy or the authenticity of their teaching at the Fourth Council. One were the Sarvastivadins that I have just been talking about. The other was a relatively new and a relatively amorphous or ill-defined school, a school called the Sutrantikas. The Sutrantikas were a school that began to be critical of the realism, the pluralism of the Sarvastivada. So many of the factors that the Sarvastivada regarded as real, the Sutrantikas regarded as mentally created, as the products of imagination, vikalpa, products of the mind, just mental formulations, not as real, independent objects. The meaning of the name Sutrantika comes from the term those who adhere to the sutras or the suttas. They when you look at a textbook on the evolution of Buddhist schools, you will see certainly that the principal division between the Sutrantikas and the Sarvastivadins, or as they then came to be called, the Vibhashikas, the followers of the commentaries, the followers of the Vibhasha. The principal difference you will see according to most of the traditional textbooks is that the Sarvastivadins believed that the Abhidharma was the word of the Buddha, whereas the Sutrantikas did not accept this. Sutrantikas said, we have to go back to the suttas, or to the sutras. We have to go back to the words of the Buddha. The Abhidharma is not the words of the Buddha. The Abhidharma is commentaries. So this was this is the textbook difference between the Sutrantikas, which were a kind of upstart school, a reactive school, let's say, that they were a school that emerged in reaction, in response to the ultra-pluralism, realism, the multiplication of dharmas, the multiplication of factors that the Sarvastivadin Abhidharma engaged in. This is a very interesting and very fruitful area. Recently we've had books published, we've had the Sarvastivada Abhidharma translated from Chinese. It had been lost in Sanskrit. These are new pieces of the puzzle that have come into the hands of scholars now to help us to put together some kind of picture of what happened for the 500 years, during the 500 years from the time of the Buddha until the first century. So the Sutrantikas rejected the Abhidharma. This is also interesting because it came in very handy for Mahayana, for proponents of the Mahayana, because when the Theravada or Hinayana. I don't like to use the term Hinayana. It was a polemical term. It was a term that was evolved, according to some, as a result of the divisions at the Second Council. The Staviras, the elders, called the dissenting party, those who were carrying salt in a horn and so forth, referred to them as Papa Bhikkhus, or sinful monks. And the sinful monks retaliated by calling the elders followers of the Hinayana. I'm not certain about the truth of this story, but it is a story that has been has come down to us over the centuries. When the Hinayanas or the Theravadins said to the Mahayanas, "Oh, look, we don't accept your scriptures. We don't accept the Mahayana sutras." So the proponents of the Mahayana could always come back and say, "Well, you people also don't agree upon your sutras. You also don't agree upon your texts, because the Sutrantikas don't accept the Abhidharma, whereas the Vipassikas do." So this is one of the issues that arose at the Fourth Council. Is or is not the Abhidharma the word of the Buddha? Now, I don't know whether I need to try to answer this question in the context of this course and for you people. I think you will come across the question elsewhere, and you will come across some answers. Very briefly, I think that most scholars today agree that the Abhidharma is not word for word Buddha Vachana. On the other hand, most scholars agree that the Abhidharma, to a large extent, was inspired by the Buddha. And in fact, we have discourses in the Sutta Pitaka that are very Abhidharmic in their character. Anyway, at this council, the Vibhashikas, or the Sarvastivadins, later to be known as the Vibhashikas, they were victorious. They won the day at the council, and the Sutrantikas were disgraced, expelled, etc. Again, the Sutrantikas didn't go away and disappear. The Sutrantikas, in a sense, disappeared, but they remained a very important influence. They remained an important influence because of their critical attitude, because they became, to a certain extent, anti-realistic. I want to be sure that I'm not using a term like realism and realistic, and you don't understand what I mean when I say a realistic school as opposed to one that is critical. It's a pretty basic division in philosophy. What it means really is that a realistic school believes that things exist in their own right, that they exist by themselves. A critical school tends to think, well, I mean, does this really exist, or is it just imagined? Is it just a product of mind? Is it just something that exists by combination of circumstances? So this critical quality of the Sutrantikas became extremely important. It became one of the major characteristics of the Mahayana, particularly of the Madhyamaka school. The critical characteristic, even of the Yogacara school, even of the mind-only school, where everything becomes mind. So in that sense, the Sutrantikas, who were the losers at the Fourth Council, they also their ideas also filtered through into Mahayana doctrine and remained important because of that. Actually, the Sarvastivada school from that point on, although it didn't disappear, it never really gained much more importance. The council composed a number of commentaries on the Abhidharma called the Vibhasha. These were inscribed on clay, on copper sheets. We have some literary production as a result of the views of the Kashmiri Vibhashikas, of the Vibhashikas that were at the council. We have, for example, the Abhidharma Kosha of Vasubandhu, which is written largely from the point of view of the Vibhashikas. So the Vibhashikas remained as a sort of... this was kind of the high water mark. This was kind of the peak of the Sarvastivadin contribution to the evolution of Buddhist thought. On the one hand, this very elaborate system of dharmas, very realistic Abhidharma, incidentally more realistic even than the Theravada Abhidharma, very realistic conception of the Abhidharma, of the system of factors. And on the other hand, this notion of bodhisattvas and future Buddhas and the cult of the Jatakas, the cult of the previous lives of the Buddha, these are the religious contributions. So these were the contributions of the Sarvastivadins. After that, although they remained, they continued to exist in India for several hundred years, but they never really made an important philosophical contribution to the evolution of Buddhism. Okay, now at this point we've come to the end of the story of the schools and of the councils. And I've done it very briefly, and I've tried just to highlight some aspects that were important or significant for understanding the origins of the Mahayana. Now let us turn the page, so to speak, and let us look at the Mahayana per se. Let us look at the Mahayana itself. And the first point that I want to make is one which is historical and factual. And that is, now I don't mean literally turn the page, I'm sorry. We're still on lecture one. The fact is that by the first century CE, the Mahayana was in existence all over India. It was being taught in the west, it was being taught in the area around Nalanda, it was being taught in the south. All of a sudden, the Mahayana is a reality. The Mahayana exists. It's popular throughout India. There are Mahayana centers in most parts of India. All of the councils, the councils never really addressed the issues of the Mahayana. They never directly confronted the Mahayana. The councils were kind of, it was like, they were like meetings of the group of seven or group of eight or something like that. They never invite Brazil or India or, they were just on their own debating their own strategies and their own points. But the councils were a little bit like that. They were just meetings of the so-called Hinayana schools or the Abhidharma schools. They didn't address the issues of the Mahayana. They didn't address the challenge of the Mahayana. But all of a sudden, in the first century CE, we find that the Mahayana is popular. The Mahayana is being taught all over and being studied all over and is acquiring followers throughout India and throughout the newly Buddhist countries of Central Asia. Now, where did the Mahayana texts come from? Where did the major Mahayana scriptures and teachings, where did they come from? This is a very difficult issue, and I struggled myself with this issue for a long time, because the Theravada tradition gives us a very realistic, a very natural, a very normal account of the origin of the Theravada text, of the Pali text. Ananda remembered what the Buddha taught. The arhats got together after the death of the Buddha. They memorized what Ananda had recalled of the teachings of the Buddha. And there you are. You have the Theravada canon. Then, of course, the Abhidhamma was added later, but there were various explanations how the tradition came by the Abhidhamma and so on. But for the Mahayana, it is more difficult. It's more difficult because what does the Mahayana tell us about the text? I mean, we have some, just a very brief reference to the Mahasanghikas making a collection of their own texts. None of the Mahayana traditions pay too much attention to that. All of a sudden, we have Mahayana texts appearing here, there, everywhere. And if you look at the account of the Mahayana itself, what do Mahayana writers, historians, and so forth, what do they say about the origin of the Mahayana text? They say that, oh, well, they came from Maitreya, the future Buddha. Future Buddha came and gave a bunch of Mahayana texts to scholar X. Manjushri, one of the Mahayana Bodhisattvas, comes down from the heavens and gives another scholar another bunch of Mahayana texts. Nagarjuna happens to notice, he's giving a talk one day outdoors. After the talk, he notices the two young men disappear beneath the ground. The next time he's giving a talk outdoors, he sees these two young men again, and I suppose he ends his talk suddenly, and he approaches these two young men and he says, "Who are you?" And they say, "We're Nagas. Come with us." And they take Nagarjuna to the Naga world and they give him the Prajnaparamita Sutras, the Perfection of Wisdom Discourses. So Nagarjuna gets the Perfection of Wisdom Discourses from the Nagas. Now, as Western historians, as objective historians, traditionally we have found it much easier to accept the Theravada account of the origin of their canon, of the origin of their text. After all, that's a fairly everyday sort of, making allowances for the fact that this Theravada canon existed as an oral tradition, was not written down until 500 years after the lifetime of the Buddha, but making allowances for that, it's pretty straightforward. It's something that we can all understand. It leaves room for quite a few slips. It leaves room for quite a few discrepancies, in the sense that we can all, let us all admit that the monks had fantastically good memories. But even so, if I tell her a story, and then she tells you a story, and then you tell him or her a story, and so on, and this goes on for 500 years, we have to wonder whether there wasn't some slippage, some change, some divergence from the original story. Never mind. Still, the process is within our normal range of experience, something which happens all the time. Changes can take place, of course. There can be some discrepancies. They did not have photocopiers in those days. They didn't have the written text. They had only oral tradition. I'm not saying oral tradition is not reliable. In many cases, it is. people were used to relying on oral tradition in those days. We've become too used to relying on notes. That's why we can't remember anything anymore. But the Mahayana story is more difficult to swallow. These heavenly bodhisattvas and these future Buddhas came down and gave people the texts and so on and so forth. Now, I was thinking about this again just recently, because this has always been a little bit of a problem for me. Thinking about this again in the last few days before coming down here to teach this course, and it occurs to me that probably in the first century CE, nowadays, if you tell someone this text comes from Maitreya, the future Buddha, nowadays we have a tendency to be skeptical. We have a tendency to say, well, you know, this is just, how am I supposed to believe that? But in the first century CE, I have a feeling that if you told someone this text comes from Maitreya, they would have thought, wow, this must be really an important teaching. I mean, this must be really a special teaching. So that ascribing the origin of the Mahayana Sutras to these celestial beings, to these extraordinary beings, the future Buddha, the Bodhisattva Maitreya, the Nagas, I think in the first century CE, it was a point of prestige. It was a selling point. It wasn't something that made people skeptical. It was something that made people believe. Because in those days, people believed. I mean, we, unfortunately, I think it is our loss that we don't believe. We should believe more. We've become too scientific. We've become too objective. I mean, I have nothing against science, but the fact is that we have narrowed our capacity to understand and to appreciate by demanding certain criteria. So, the fact is that, accept it or not, the Mahayana texts, the major Mahayana texts, were in existence in the first century CE. Where did they come from? Did they come from Maitreya? Were they preserved in the memories of other schools, like people like Purana, people who were sort of outsiders, outside the mainstream? This is also possible. Western scholars have gone to such lengths since they had such difficulty accepting the fact that Nagarjuna got the perfection of wisdom discourses from the Nagas, whom Western scholars don't even believe exist. They had so much difficulty accepting this that they formulated a theory that Nagas were just a code name for a group of yogis. So you see, at least they came from human beings. I mean, they may have been human beings on the fringe, but at least they came from human beings. But let's just put all of this aside for the moment. I don't think any school of Buddhism denies the necessity for a little bit of faith. And the historical fact is that the Mahayana texts, the major Mahayana texts, were in existence by the first century CE. And this is the final point I want to make about the canons, about the texts, and so forth. The final point I want to make is that, again, the standard wisdom, and the wisdom which, of course, for every reason, the Theravada school has wanted to support, wanted to sustain, the traditional wisdom is that the Theravada texts are earlier, the Mahayana texts are later. But if we look, and now again I will invoke objectivity, historical objectivity, scientific method. If we look at the question objectively, scientifically, there is very little to divide the Theravada texts from the Mahayana texts, in the sense that the Theravada texts were written down in about 50 BCE, 500 years after the time of the Buddha, in the middle of the first century BCE. The major Mahayana texts we know are already in existence in the first century CE. So in strictly historical terms, in terms of the text, and when I say the text, I mean the physical documents, not the tradition, but the physical documents, the written texts, the canons, there is hardly 100 years that separates the Theravada text from the Mahayana text. Maybe not even that much, because some of the major Mahayana sutras, like the Lotus Sutra, like the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, could very well have been written down in the first century BCE. So what I'm saying is that the idea that the Theravada texts are factually, historically, objectively earlier than the Mahayana sutras, than the Mahayana scriptures, this cannot be sustained satisfactorily. It cannot be proven. There is no hard evidence that the Theravada canon as a written document was substantially older than the Mahayana canon, than the Mahayana scriptures. If we're talking about oral tradition, then it's an open question again, because just as the Theravada texts could have survived in an oral tradition, the Mahayana texts could also have existed in an oral tradition. So if we're talking about documents, if we're talking about written texts, the dates are so close together that it's very hard to make any judgment about priority and successiveness, or you know, about earlier and later. The earlier and later assertion is a very shaky one. It's one that's difficult to maintain, difficult to defend in objective historical scientific terms. So my point when I say this is simply that you cannot just discard the Mahayana scriptures by saying they're later inventions and so on and so forth. It is also true that the in terms of documents, you know, you want to talk about written documents, actual physical written documents, the age of actual physical written documents. Not too many years ago, the British Library came upon, acquired in mysterious circumstances, a set of texts from Afghanistan. They're written in Kharoshthi. They date from the 1st or 2nd century CE. They are some of the oldest documents that exist. They happen to be what we would call Hinayana documents. They're not Mahayana documents. They contain, for example, the discourse on the rhinoceros and so on. But apart from that, for most of the history of Buddhist scholarship, do you know what the oldest printed Buddhist text is? The oldest printed Buddhist text that still exists? It's a copy of the Diamond Sutra, the Vajracchedika, and it dates from 846 or something like that CE. And of course this is about 800 years before Gutenberg invented his printing press. It is the oldest printed document. So if we're talking about documents, we don't have any real evidence upon which to make a statement about whether the Theravada teaching or the Mahayana teaching is earlier or older or first. So let's put that aside now. Let's put aside the question of documents and texts and canons and so forth. And let's talk about the psychology and the sociology of Buddhism during this period. And when I say during this period, I mean the 500 years after the time of the Buddha. During this period we had, as best I can tell, we had three groups who were, if you like, representing different inclinations, different interests within the Buddhist community. You had the elders, the staviras, the senior monks. You had the junior monks, and you had the laity. You had the lay people. And these three groups reflect different degrees of conservatism. The elder monks, the staviras, were very conservative. Their interest was always preservation. Keep all the precepts. Don't throw out even the most minor precept. Keep everything. Don't hold fast to the doctrine as it was formulated during the first council. Their philosophy, their attitude was one of conservation. You had the junior monks who were more liberal, who were interested in other ideas, in other interpretations, who were open to other interpretations, who were willing in practice, if not in letter, to relax some of the precepts. And then finally you had the laity, who had their own interests, who had their own agenda, who wanted a Buddhism that meant something to them in their everyday lives. They wanted a Sarvastivada monastery smack dab in the middle of the city. They weren't all in a position to ride on elephants and go and visit the learned monks in their monasteries in the forest. They wanted to be close to the Buddhist community, to the masters and to the monks. So the elders, the juniors and the laity, they all had their own priorities, their own inclinations. And the story of the rise and the popularity of the Mahayana is really the story of how these three groups played off against each other and how they adopted, how they developed, or the choices that they made in how they interpreted the teaching of the Buddha, how they interpreted Buddhism. And the principal choice that they had to make was they had to choose between two ideals of religious life. And here we are going to have to talk about the Arhat and the Buddha, or alternatively the Arhat and the Bodhisattva. So the junior monks, the lay people, they were given a choice. Basically, they had a choice. They could be Buddhist, follow the Buddhist path, and have in mind the ideal of the Arhat, the ideal of individual liberation, the ideal of entering into parinirvana. On the one hand, that was one choice that they were given. That was the choice they were given by the elders. That was the choice they were given by the elder monks, by the conservatives. On the other hand, the younger monks, the Mahayana tradition in general, gave them another choice. Follow the example of the Buddha. Be a bodhisattva. You have less, you have a more liberal interpretation of discipline, more liberal interpretation of morality, of the monastic code. You have many lifetimes to develop your perfection, to develop your qualities, and at the end of the day you can become a Buddha with all the immense qualities and all the immense attributes that a Buddha possesses. So when the people of the first century CE were presented with this choice, become an Arhat or become a Buddha, follow the way of the elders and become an arhat and disappear into nirvana. Or follow the way of the bodhisattva, follow the way of the Mahayana, practice the bodhisattva path. Yes, it's long. Yes, it's difficult. But you will have a lot of interesting experiences on the way, and eventually you will become a Buddha. And after all, this was the path that the founder of the tradition, that the Buddha, this was the path that he followed. So why not follow the Mahayana path? Why not follow the Bodhisattva path? Why not take as your ideal the ideal of the Bodhisattva rather than the ideal of the Arhat? And I really think that it was this choice that carried the day in the first century CE. That is why the Mahayana became so popular throughout India, throughout Central Asia, why there were even flirtations with the Mahayana in Sri Lanka, in Burma, even in Thailand, in other countries of Southeast Asia. In most cases, the Mahayana was eventually eliminated from those countries for political, historical reasons. But the Mahayana gained great popularity because of this ideal of the Bodhisattva, which is very appealing, I think, no matter what tradition you ascribe to. And in fact, in actual fact, I hesitate to say this because there are many members of the Theravada Sangha here, but I believe that there are many members of the Theravada Sangha who pursue the Bodhisattva path, who aspire to become Bodhisattvas. There was a very famous teacher, visited Singapore quite often, from Sri Lanka, Venerable Narada Thera, Mahathera, who said openly that he was a follower of the Bodhisattva path, that he aspired to become a Buddha. So I think even within the Theravada tradition you will find many practitioners, and it is possible because, as I told you this morning, the Theravada tradition does not reject the Bodhisattva path and it does not reject the goal of Buddhahood. What it says simply is that it's very difficult, it's a very long road, so may as well strive to become an arhat. But I think that the popularity of the Mahayana can be accounted for by this, the appeal, the attraction that this choice of following the Bodhisattva path had. And then in addition to that, the Mahayana had all of this other, we might call them marketing techniques nowadays, really. It had all these other things. I mean, it had, you know, the figures of the Bodhisattvas, these glorious figures, you know, with all their supernatural qualities. The Mahayana had all these, what came to be called skillful means, skillful devices, you know, ways whereby people could be led by stages. So that if you can't do this practice, you can do another practice. You had a choice. You didn't have only one or two practices. You had many different practices. And then you had the great compassion of the Mahayana. The fact that the Mahayana is always ready to forgive. The Mahayana is always ready. All right, you may have made a mistake. You may not have gotten it quite right. Never mind. Try again. It will be all right. This sort of attitude of the Mahayana won over the laity. And that's why the Mahayana was able to achieve such great popularity throughout India. And, as a result of this, it became an important tradition. It became an important constituency within Buddhism, a very important constituency within Buddhism. And it spread. It spread with Buddhism to Central Asia, to China, and so forth. Now, I'm going to move next to a discussion of the Mahayana elements within the Pali sources, within the Pali texts. But before I do that, I want to make one last point. And the point that I want to make, again, about the 500 years between the lifetime of the Buddha and the emergence of the full-fledged Mahayana, because scholars now agree that the full-fledged Mahayana emerged by the first century CE. So the point that I want to make is, what about these 500 years between the lifetime of the Buddha and the first century CE, when we have side by side existing a Theravada or Staviravada tradition, and on the other hand, a Mahayana tradition which is already popular and widespread. And I want to point out that now we imagine that we know quite a lot about this period. The fact is, we still know precious little about this period. We know precious little about this period, and I'll give you an example how little we really know. Now we know a lot more than we did 100 years ago, but this period is still a very obscure period, a very clouded period. And no wonder, it was 2,000 years ago, and there were very few historical records. But I'll just give you one example that will illustrate what I mean about how little we knew about that period. And now, of course, we know a lot more, but that doesn't mean that we know everything or that we have a complete picture of what happened during those 500 years. But there had always existed in Buddhist countries, in Theravada Buddhist countries particularly, but even in Mahayana Buddhist countries, there had always existed this, what was 100 years ago, what was regarded as a legend about a great Buddhist emperor, a certain Ashoka, who had converted to Buddhism and who had spread Buddhism and promoted Buddhism. This was a legend. This was regarded by Western scholars as a Buddhist myth, a Buddhist legend. Then when the British began to excavate various sites around India, they began to come across these rock inscriptions, these pillars, and so forth. All over India there are so many, no? 20, 32 major, 18 minor, something like that. Many, many pillars and rock inscriptions. And they began, one by one, they began to find these rock inscriptions. And the British were very, the archaeologists who were working on the project were very puzzled, because these inscriptions all refer to Deva Piyadasi. They all referred to Piyadasi. And the archaeologist said, who is this Piyadasi? Who is this great king who went around inscribing stones with Buddhist suttas and things like that? Who was he anyway? And they never, it took them quite a long time to put two and two together and realize that, the Ashoka of the Buddhist legends is the Piyadasi of these rock inscriptions, of these pillars. It took them a long time to come around to that conclusion. For a long time, who is this Piyadasi? There were early Indologists who doubted that the Buddha even ever existed. So you can see that when we try to put a picture together of the early period, the first 500 years after the life of the Buddha, we're really working with very limited materials, and we really have very little hard evidence. It's getting better, as I said, it's getting better. But again, a lot of the material that is coming to light now is not from that period, it is from the post-Common Era period, but it is throwing some light on the evolution of schools within that 500-year period. But it is still a period which is very, very much shrouded in mystery, very much covered by the mist of time. It's not, from my point of view, and I tend to be a little bit practical in this respect. From my point of view, it doesn't matter too much. We have the Mahayana, we have the Theravada, we have the teachings. We're supposed to be, I think, most of us, primarily interested in practice, not in writing PhD dissertations. The PhD dissertation may be a byproduct, it may be helpful, but our principal interest is in practice and liberation. So we don't need to really worry about which school of the Mahasanghikas held which views, since all these schools now are dust. All these schools, all that is left of these schools is what they contributed to the Buddhism that existed later, developed later. So, to some degree, it is an academic, in inverted commas, exercise that we don't have to worry too much about. Okay, now you can turn the page. Now you can go to the next. The second page of notes, the lecture two, topic two. Now, I find this actually more interesting than an historical discussion of the of the evolution of schools. And here I want to talk about the elements, the Mahayana elements that are found in the Theravada tradition. I began this course by referring to the fact that we need not look any further than the life, career, and teaching of the Buddha to find the fundamental model, the essential model for the Mahayana path and the Mahayana tradition. I want to be a little bit more specific now. I want to be textual. I want to look at the Pali Canon and look at evidence within the Pali Canon of the Mahayana doctrines, of important Mahayana doctrines. And there is a lot, I mean, a lot meaning not in terms of quantity, but the evidence of the Mahayana that we can find in the Pali sources is very weighty, very convincing. It carries a lot of importance. So, first of all, I want to refer to the Buddha's decision to teach. Now, someone here this morning asked about, well, if the Buddha was so compassionate and he could have lived for an aeon, why did he enter Parinirvana and abandon everyone? And even though Ananda, you know, why this problem with Ananda? Why does Ananda have to take the blame? And of course, it's a very good question, and I said I won't answer it because the Lotus Sutra answers it better than I could possibly answer it. But there's a similar event which happened shortly after the Buddha's enlightenment. Shortly after the Buddha's enlightenment, and this is recorded in the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, shortly after the Buddha's enlightenment, the Buddha is thinking to himself, this Dharma that I have discovered is very deep, it's very profound. Most people are too caught up in the passions and the poisons of this world. They're not going to understand. They won't be able to appreciate this Dharma. If I should try to teach this Dharma, it will be a nuisance for me. It will be troublesome for me. So why shouldn't I just rest? Why shouldn't I just enjoy the fruit of my realization? Now again, the Buddha is so compassionate, how can he think like this, you know? How can he think like this? But the fact is that this is said in the Pali text, the Buddha reflected in this way. And what happened? And now you at this point I will say, well, you see, we need the intervention of the gods, even in the Theravada tradition, to make things happen. Because even according to the Theravada tradition, the Buddha might never have left the palace if the gods hadn't made him see the old man, the sick man, and the corpse. It took the gods to make him see that. And now here again, the Buddha is thinking about retiring into Parinirvana without teaching. Actually, there's another text, and I don't know, to tell you the truth, I can't remember now whether it's a Mahayana text or a Theravada text, but there is another text where Mara comes to the Buddha and says, okay, now you've become a Buddha, now why do you want to hang around? Why don't you just go into Parinirvana? And the Buddha refuses. Anyway, according to this text, the Arya Parihasana Sutta, the Buddha reflects in this way, it will be a trouble to me, it will be a nuisance to me if I try to teach and people don't understand. And what happens? Brahma Sampatti comes to the Buddha. Brahma Sampatti sees what the Buddha is thinking. He's the highest of the gods. He comes to the Buddha, he kneels down before the Buddha and he says, Lord, please, you know, don't think about retiring. Teach the Dharma for the benefit of the world, and so forth. Now, here again, one might say, why do we need Brahma Sampatti? Why do we need him? I mean, I don't need him, personally. But I think, again, it was for the prestige. You know, for the people of that time, it was something significant that the highest of the gods should come and request the Buddha to teach. It also makes the relationship between the Buddha and the highest of the Brahmanical gods quite clear. The highest of the Brahmanical gods is a devotee, a disciple, a supplicant at the feet of the Buddha. Anyway, Brahma Sampatti comes and says, oh Lord, please, you know, you must teach, otherwise the world is lost, etc., etc. And so then the Buddha reflects, he thinks again, and he says, well, in fact, yes, there are some people in this world who have little dust in their eyes and who may understand, and he calls to mind this image, the simile of the lotuses in a pond and so forth. And so he decides to teach. Now, to my mind, this is the beginning of the Mahayana, right there. When the Buddha decides to teach and not to retire into Nirvana, this is the beginning of the Mahayana. He decides out of compassion for the benefit of the beings of the world. He decides to teach. This is absolutely Mahayanic in its tone, in its character. So the Buddha decides to teach. Now, the next point that I want to make is that in the text, and for this you need to look at the Mulapariyaya Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya. It's a very difficult text, but Dutt does summarize it quite well in his chapter. It's a very difficult text, and it's one of the few texts, normally if you read the Pali texts in the Pali Suttas, in the Pali Nikayas, after the Buddha has delivered a sermon, everybody is very happy, no? Everybody praises the Buddha. The Mulapariyaya is an exception to this. The Buddha delivers the discourse, and all the monks are sort of, what did he say, you know? Very strange, you know, they didn't like it. They didn't like the discourse. And then, of course, one of the commentaries explains that later on they understood it and they came back and they said that it was very nice. But the actual text ends with the monks being dissatisfied with the Mulapariyaya Sutta. And it is a very difficult sutta. But the point that I want to make about the sutta is that it distinguishes very clearly the Buddha from the Arhat. according to this sutta, the Buddha is without any conceptions. The Buddha is free from all conceptions. The Buddha is free from all relations. You know, the Buddha's mind, the Buddha's consciousness is untraceable. So he is different from the arhat. And he's different from the arhat. Why? Because even when we recite the homage to the Buddha, we refer to him as an arhat, but then we also refer to him as the Sammasambuddha. And the achievement of the Buddha, which is different from the achievement of the arhat, is Sambodhi, perfect enlightenment. Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, we say in the term, in the Mahayana tradition, in the Sanskrit tradition, the highest, complete and perfect enlightenment. And this is the characteristic of the Buddha, and this distinguishes the Buddha from the arhat. And nowhere in the Pali text do we have any suggestion that the Buddha and the arhat are equal. The Buddha is always superior to the arhat. I'll just tell you a story that illustrates this. It happened at the time when the Buddha was passing away. This is also there in the Nirvana, Parinirvana Sutta in the Pali text. The Buddha is passing away, Ananda is fanning the Buddha. And the Buddha says to Ananda, just get out of the way. Stand aside. And one of the other arhats, I don't remember now who it was, Anuruddha or one of the others, he thinks to himself, this is very strange. I mean, Ananda has been the Buddha's faithful servant for all these years, and why should the Buddha rebuke him in this way now that he is at the point of death and so forth? And so he asks the Buddha, he says, why did you rebuke Ananda in this way? And the Buddha says, don't you see, don't you know that all around here there are thousands, millions of devas, yakkas, other beings that are all crowded here so tightly that you could not put the blade of a knife between one and the other. And they're all assembled here to see the Tathagata before he enters into Parinirvana. And this Ananda is blocking the view. He's standing between me and this assembly of extraterrestrial beings. And there also you can see immediately the difference between the Buddha and the arhats. The arhats were not aware of this. The Buddha could see these beings, all wanting to get a look at the Tathagata in his last moments. And so the Buddha had incredible powers that the arhats didn't share. Then we have all of these references, various references in the Pali text, which equate the Buddha with the Dhamma. I've had discussions about this with a number of people. Some of them tell me they can't find this quote exactly in the mouth of the Buddha in the Pali text. He who sees interdependent origination sees the Dhamma. The monk who sees interdependent origination sees the Dhamma. He who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. I found the first part of it. It's in the sutta delivered by the elephant footprint simile sutta delivered by Sariputra. The first part I found, he who sees the interdependent origination sees the Dhamma. The last part, which is the more important part, I haven't found there. It does exist in a Mahayana sutra called the Shalistambha Sutta. And someone told me in another place, it is said by Sariputta, he who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. But in general, there is a feeling, even in the Pali text, that he who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. That is a suggestion that the Buddha's physical form is not what is important. What is important is seeing the Dhamma. If you see the Dhamma, you see the Buddha. So again, there is an equation here between Buddha and Dhamma, that the reality of the Buddha is not the physical body, but the reality of the Buddha is the Dhamma. If you like, what later came to be called the Dharmakaya, the Dharma body of the Buddha in the Mahayana tradition. So we already have a suggestion of this. We have another very, very interesting episode that took place during the lifetime of the Buddha. And this is really, if you think about this story, this is an amazing story, and it really gives everyone a lot of food for thought, I think. There's a story of a certain occasion when the Buddha wanted to shelter, he wanted to stay in the cow shed of a certain person for the night. Do you know this story? Have you heard this story? He wanted to stay in the cow shed of a certain person for the night. So he asked the owner of the cow shed, he said, May I stay? Do you mind if I stay in your cow shed for the night? And the owner said, No, I have no objection, but there was another ascetic here earlier, and he asked to stay in the cow shed, so you have to ask him whether it's okay, because I already gave him permission to stay in the cow shed, and so it wouldn't be right for you to stay in the cow shed without asking permission from this other ascetic. And at the moment he's not here, he's gone off for alms or whatever. After a while, this ascetic comes back, and the Buddha says to this ascetic, he says, do you mind if I share the cow shed with you tonight? The ascetic says, no, not at all. The cow shed is quite big, and there's plenty of room, and you're welcome to share the cow shed with me for the night. So they share the cow shed, and this ascetic does his meditation, and he sleeps to rest for a while, and so forth. The Buddha does his meditation, rests for a while, and so on and so forth, and then... In those days, people were quite... Nowadays, you're supposed to, when you meet someone, you have to give them your card. You have to tell them who you are and so forth. In those days, people didn't do that. They would answer if they were asked, but they wouldn't say, I am so-and-so and so forth. So the Buddha never said that he was the Buddha or anything of that sort. They spent the night together. The thing is, then in the morning, the Buddha asked this monk, he says, Where are you going? What is your, what is your purpose? What is your plan? And this monk says, oh, I'm going to such and such a place. He names a town. He says, I'm going there to find the Buddha. I'm going there to meet the Buddha. So the Buddha says, okay, very good. And this ascetic, then the Buddha leaves. The Buddha takes leave and he goes. And the ascetic asked the owner of the cow shed, he says, who was that ascetic that I shared the cow shed with last night? And the owner of the cow shed says, you don't know? It was the Buddha. And the ascetic says, oh my God, it was the Buddha. I spent it. And he didn't see the Buddha. He didn't recognize the Buddha. So, even during the time of the Buddha, even when the Buddha was there in flesh and blood, you could spend the night with the Buddha and not recognize him if you didn't have the right karma, if you didn't have the right purity, the right condition of mind. I mean, there is a sequel to this story. He realizing his mistake, he follows the Buddha, and then, so on and so forth. And it has a relatively happy ending. Relatively happy ending in the sense that this ascetic is killed by a bolt of lightning, but then he's reborn in as a stream winner or something like that. But you it makes you think, no? I mean, the Buddha could be in this room right now. We wouldn't know. So there is this element of mystery about the Buddha, no? Do you see him? Don't you see him? Where is the Buddha? Can you see the Buddha? So the Buddha is always, even in the Pali sources, even according to the Theravada tradition, the Buddha has always been a supramundane being. The Buddha is not, I know it's very popular, it has been very popular for the last 100 years or so, to talk about the humanity of the Buddha, to talk about the Buddha being a man. Certainly the Buddha was a man, but after becoming a Buddha, he was no longer a man. The Buddha refers to himself as the Tathagata. He never says, you know, he says the Tathagata will go to Uruvelva. The Tathagata will go. He refers to himself in the third person. And even according to the Theravada tradition, the Buddha was always supra mundane. You know? I don't think in any Theravada country, many of you, a few of you come from Thailand, some of you have been to Sri Lanka. Do Buddhists in Thailand and Sri Lanka, do they regard the Buddha as an ordinary man? No, of course not, you know. This is a kind of, I tell you how this happened. This happened because, and to some extent, you know, when Buddhism first went to the West, 100 years ago or so, this was a period of rationalism in the West. The West was sick and tired of saints and saviors and super normal and persons and so forth. And so it was easier to promote Buddhism as a very rational system. The Buddha was a man, the Buddha was an ethical teacher, the Buddha was this and that. And this kind of fed back into the Theravada tradition, into the Theravada countries. So you get a lot of intellectuals in Theravada countries following the description, the conception of the Buddha that was promoted in the West at that time. Now that no longer matters in the West. Now if you tell people in the West that the Buddha was an extraordinary, supermundane being, now nobody minds. 100 years ago, they said, oh, this is mysticism, this is hodgepodge, this is mumbo-jumbo, and so forth. Now the cultural context, cultural climate has changed, even in the West. But one of your very good Western monks, Thanissaro Bhikkhu, he wrote very well, very nicely, that nobody in the Theravada countries ever thought of the Buddha as, you know, that it is a mistake to think of the Buddha as a Bertrand Russell in robes, you know, or to think of him as a Fritz Perl in robes. Fritz Perl was a famous Gestalt psychologist, you know. The Buddha was not that. The Buddha was a superhuman being. He was a supermundane being, according to all the accounts, even the Pali accounts. What about the miracles performed by the Buddha? How did the Buddha convert the Kasyapa, the elder of the Kasyapa brothers? The elder of the Kasyapa brothers would not listen to the Buddha at all. He had no interest in listening to the Buddha's teaching. He admired the Buddha because he was a good-looking ascetic, but he had no interest in the Buddha's teaching at all. And the Buddha performed all kinds of miracles, and this Kasyapa just ignored them. And then it so happened that Kasyapa had this chamber, which was a burning chamber. There was supposed to be a naga in there that burned up everything that came into the chamber. And the Buddha said, one day he said to Kasyapa, he said, do you mind if I spend the night in your burning chamber? And Kasyapa said, what, you must be mad. I mean, what are you talking about? You're going to be burned up. And the Buddha said, never mind, don't worry about that. I'm just asking you if I can spend the night in your burning chamber. And so Kasyapa said, well, all right. I mean, it's your lookout. Suit yourself. If you want to spend the night in the burning chamber, go ahead. So the Buddha went into the chamber for the night, and all night the chamber burned brightly, hotly, became a mass of flames. And everybody said, oh, well, that is it. I mean, that's the Buddha. Finished. And in the morning, the Buddha came out perfectly all right, and in his begging bowl, he had this little snake that was the naga that had been the ruler of the burning chamber. The Buddha survived the flames of that burning chamber throughout the night. Buddha performed all kinds of miracles. He performed miracles for the Sakyans, to convince the Sakyans. You know, so there were all kinds of miracles. It's become, as I said, this sanitized, westernized version of Buddhism tends to ignore or eliminate the miracles. I remember when I was working with the school project in Singapore, government told us, no miracles. Can't put any miracles in the text. I don't know why. I mean, the Christians have their miracles. Why can't we have ours, you know? In fact, I rewrote that part of the text recently, and I put in the miracles. I think the miracles should be there. And then there's also the question of the manifestations. What about the manifestations of the Buddha? You know, what about when? I think you must know the story of Queen Kshema in Pali, one of the wives of King Bimbisara. Is very fond of beautiful things. She herself was very beautiful. And King Bimbisara wanted to get her interested in the Dharma, but she wasn't very interested in the Dharma. So one day, as a skillful device, as an instance of Upaya Kaushalya, the king said to his queen, oh, why don't you go and see the bamboo grove? The bamboo grove is very beautiful, you'll like it. Knowing that the Buddha was staying in the bamboo grove. So she went to the bamboo grove, and she, of course, liked the bamboo grove. Now, the Buddha, when he saw her coming, the Buddha created, magically manifested, the figure of a beautiful young woman. And Queen Kshema, having some interest herself in her own beauty, she was fascinated by this beautiful young woman. She thought, is she more beautiful than me? You know, let me have a look. Anyway, as Queen Kshema looked at this beautiful young woman, within the space of a few minutes, she became old, her skin became wrinkled, her hair became white and frizzy, her teeth fell out, her skin became loose, and then she collapsed upon the ground into a heap of bones. And this was all a show. The Buddha put on this show. He projected, he manifested this form of this young woman. Why? In order to teach Queen Kshema the impermanence of beauty, the impermanence of life. And in fact, Queen Kshema, she understood the truth of impermanence. She became a nun, and she became one of the most famous nuns. She became one of the few nuns ever to lecture the monks on philosophy, on impermanence, wisdom. So the Buddha had these powers. The Buddha was not just a nice man who had, you know, good teachings. The Buddha was a person with extraordinary powers. The Buddha went to heaven. The Buddha created dummies of himself, models of himself, walking, talking projections of himself. The Buddha was able to teach in any language that he chose. You know, they're all these attributes of the Buddha. Even according to the Theravada sources, the Buddha was not by any means an ordinary person. He was superhuman. He was super mundane. Now, we can discuss, we can debate how super mundane he was. Was he that much super mundane? Was he that much super mundane? You know, this is the debate between the Mahayana and the Theravada about the supernatural nature of the Buddha. How supernatural was he? Well, You know, the Theravada tradition may have one view, the Mahayana tradition may have another view, but there's no real debate about whether the Buddha was supramundane or not. He was certainly supramundane. He was not an ordinary being. I mean, how extraordinary was he? Well, we'll see when we read the Mahayana sutras. But the fact is that there's no real argument about, even looking at the Theravada text, the Buddha was certainly extraordinary. And now we come to the whole story about the Buddha's metaphysics, shall we call it that? I don't like the word particularly, but let us call it that, or let us call it the Buddha's philosophy. One of the most famous texts for the Mahayana tradition, one of the most important texts for the Mahayana tradition. In fact, there are some people who believe that the entire Mula Madhyamaka Karika, which is the greatest and the largest of Nagarjuna's texts, the Mula Madhyamaka Karika is based, it is a commentary on the Kacchayanagota Sutta of the Pali Canon. It's interesting when you read Nagarjuna next time, in January, when we study the Madhyamaka, we will read some excerpts from the writing of Nagarjuna. And Nagarjuna, in general, even though he said to have discovered the Prajnaparamita, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras from the Naga world, in his text, Nagarjuna almost exclusively cites Pali sources. I mean, not when I say he cites Pali sources, he doesn't cite them in Pali, but he cites quotations, he cites statements of the Buddha that you can find in the Pali text, in the Pali canon. So there are some who say the Mula Madhyamaka Karika is a commentary on the Kacchayanagota Sutta. What does the Buddha say to Kacchayana? The Buddha says, it's the discourse is on right view. And the Buddha says, the world is used to relying upon existence and non-existence. You cannot achieve liberation so long as you rely upon existence and non-existence. You have to go beyond existence and non-existence to achieve liberation. And then, in this same vein, we have the Buddha's silence, the famous silence of the Buddha. Why did the Buddha not reply to those 14 propositions, those 14, why do we have these 14 avyakrita? That the world is finite, that the world is infinite, that the world is eternal, that the world is not, that the Tathagata lives after death, that he does not. That the soul, the self, the living being is identical with the body, that it is not. The Buddha refused to agree to any of these, no? There are four alternatives for the first three questions. Finite, infinite, both, neither. Eternal, not, both, neither. Existent, not, both, neither. Which again, this is called the Tetralemma, the Chatuskoti. We find the same formulation in the Mahayana texts. And this we find all over. There are many instances of this in the Chulamalunkya Sutta, in the Agivachagota Sutta, in the Yamaka Sutta. We find them cropping up again and again in the Pali Canon. In every place, the Buddha refuses to agree to these propositions. Now, why does he refuse to agree to these propositions? This has been a source of great perplexity for scholars. Why did the Buddha remain silent? Some people said, well, the Buddha didn't know. Some people said, well, the Buddha was primarily interested in ethics. I mean, so these are metaphysical questions, so they didn't interest him. These are not satisfactory answers. There are certainly some practical reasons for not admitting, not accepting these 14 views. And those the Buddha more or less discloses. The Buddha more or less indicates those reasons when he says that these views do not tend to edification. The Chulamalunkya Sutta says these views do not tend to edification. That's why I teach the Four Noble Truths. I don't accept any of these views. Partly the reasons are obvious enough. The first, the questions about the world, whether it exists infinitely or whether it comes to an end, these are questions about time and space. Right? Does the world exist eternally? Does it not? Is it infinite or is it not? In other words, does it have an end in space? Does it have an end in time? And of course, there's a very good reason for not answering these questions, because if you answer these questions either way, anyway, if you answer these questions, there's no point in practice. There's no point in practice. Why practice if anyway the world is going to end tomorrow? There's no point in practicing. The world's going to end anyway. If the world is not going to end, then again there's no point in practicing, because no matter how much you practice, you're never going to get out of the world. It's going to go on and on. Then again, if the world has an end in space, if you can just walk to the end of the world, then that should be our purpose, to walk to the end of the world. But how are we going to walk to the end of the world? No one has ever been able to walk to the end of the world. On the other hand, if the world doesn't have an end, if it doesn't have an edge, if you can't fall off, then you're trapped here forever. So there, again, there's no point in practice. The questions about the Tathagata after death are also very interesting. They're interesting because it puts pay to the idea of nirvana as extinction. The Buddha explicitly says nirvana is not non-existent. You cannot say of the Tathagata after death that he does not exist. This is also the case in the discourse to Yamaka. Sariputra actually talks to Yamaka about this. Yamaka has come up with this idea that the Tathagata doesn't exist after death. And Sariputra goes to Yamaka and he says, the Tathagata, you cannot say that the Tathagata does not exist after death. You cannot say that he exists after death. And even more, even now, even that the Tathagata is here among us, that he's walking here and there among us and talking to us, even now you can't say whether he exists or doesn't exist. Never mind after death. Even while the Tathagata is alive, you can't say whether he exists or doesn't exist. And then there's the final question about the soul or the self, or the living being. Is it identical with the body or different? And again, the Buddha refuses to answer this question. Why does he refuse to answer this question? This is why everybody criticized the Vasiputriyas. Everybody criticized the Sarvastivadins because of their doctrine of existence in the three times. But the fact is that it's very, very difficult if you take a radical, if you take an absolute view of not self, if you adhere, if you cling to the doctrine of not self, it's very difficult to explain moral responsibility. It's very difficult to explain rebirth. It's very difficult to explain karma. You cannot take not self as an absolute truth. This I found in the West. In the West, people are very happy to hear about not self. They're very happy to hear about not self because they think, okay, there's no self. I'm not going to be reborn. I can do whatever I want. The thing is, the Buddha taught self to some people, to materialists, and most people are materialists. Today, certainly, most people are materialists. In the past, also, probably most people were materialists. To those people, the Buddha taught self. The Buddha taught not self to people who believe in rebirth, who believe in karma, who perform good works. To them he taught not self because he didn't want to see them trapped in samsara forever because of clinging to the self. So these 14 questions in many ways are the heart of Mahayana metaphysics. They're the heart of the Madhyamaka view of reality. I'll try to explain to you how that is so, but these are important passages in the Pali text. The Buddha also talked about emptiness. He talked about not self. He said that just as the oil in the oil lamp burns dependent upon the wick and the oil, the flame of the oil lamp is, it burns dependent upon the wick and the oil. The flame is, doesn't exist in the wick, it doesn't exist in the oil, it doesn't exist any place in between. And in the same way, all things that exist interdependently are without self-existence, they're without swabhava, they're empty. The Buddha said that all phenomena were like foam, like bubbles, they had no substance. The Buddha used the parable of the raft. He said you have to abandon all dharmas. You don't hold on even to the good dharmas. The dharma is like a raft. Once you've crossed the river with the help of a raft, you don't carry it on your shoulders. You don't cling to it. You let go of it. The Buddha talked about the discourses dealing with shunyata. He said the monks of the future generation, they will be interested in poetic discourses, in discourses made by poets, adorned with pretty words. They won't be interested in the discourses that deal with shunyata, that go beyond the world. This is a very interesting statement. It shows that the Buddha regarded the discourses dealing with shunyata as the highest, the deepest of his teachings. Excuse me. And then the Buddha talked a lot about the importance of the mind as well. Buddhism is at least 80% about mind. Look at the system of the five aggregates. Four of them are mental. Only one is physical. Look at the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas, look at the 37 factors conducive to enlightenment. I did, just for fun, one day I did a quantitative analysis of the 37 factors. Something like 28 of 37 are mental factors. So the mind always had a very central role in the teaching of the Buddha. And we also have a conception in the Pali Canon about the nature of the mind. The mind is featureless, the mind is pure, the mind shines like a jewel. It's luminescent, luminous. It's beyond earth, water, fire, air, and so forth. And consciousness or mind is also creative. Everybody knows the first verses of the Dhammapada. Mind is the creator of all dhammas. All dhammas are mind-made. It's the forerunner. It's the forerunner of all dhammas. All dhammas are mind-made. Now, what do we mean by dhammas? The whole question there is, what do we mean by dhammas? How do we interpret this term dhammas, factors? Some people translate it mental states, but you don't have to translate it mental states. You can translate it things. If you translate it things, it has an entirely different meaning, a much more profound meaning than mental states. Certainly the mind obviously is the forerunner of mental states. But if you say all things are mind-made, then you're right smack dab in agreement with the mind-only philosophy, the Yogacara philosophy. The Buddha also talked about a certain asura king by the name of Vipachitta, who was bound or freed according to the good or bad nature of his thoughts. So his mind created his reality, conditioned his reality, made him bound or free according to his mental states. So all of these elements that become central and are central doctrines of the Mahayana, they are suggested in the Pali Canon. It isn't that they are absent from the Pali Canon. They are there. We just need to look for them. Professor Dutt does quite a good job of doing that. Other people also do it. It has become quite generally accepted now that there are significant traces of Mahayana doctrines even in the Pali Canon. So let us accept that we have an integrated development, an organic evolution of Buddhism, a fundamental indissoluble link between the Buddha's teaching as we find it in the Theravada canon and as we find it in the Mahayana. We're seeing the same teaching through different spectacles, through a different optic. But the teachings are not essentially different. It is a question of a difference of emphasis, a difference of interpretation. And that's what we're going to be looking at in the next few days. I think tomorrow morning I'll have Mrs. Santina, Dr. Ghosh, whichever. I think I will have her go over some of the passages from the Pali texts that are relevant to what I've said in the second half of this evening's lecture, so that you can see for yourself in the Buddha's own words in the Pali Canon where the parallels exist, where the evidence is. And then after that, I will talk to you about the Lotus Sutra, introduce to you the Mahayana Sutra literature, and we will begin to talk about the Lotus Sutra. So, does anybody have any questions or comments before we adjourn for the day?